Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, state lawmakers kick off their 2020 legislative session on Tuesday. And boy, do they have a big agenda to tackle. Education, health care, the environment, affordable housing. It all leads up to passing a state budget of more than $90 billion.
Today, we're talking about two issues that are priorities for Governor Ron DeSantis. One was a campaign promise to require Florida companies to use the E-Verify system to check the immigration status of new workers. Now, we'll hear more about that later on in this program.
The second involves teacher pay. Andrew Gillum ran against DeSantis on a campaign to pay starting teachers in Florida $50,000 a year. Now, he lost that race, but the idea got some traction, and now DeSantis is embracing it, too. The governor wants to raise first-year teacher salaries in Florida to $47,500. That would make teachers here in Florida, Tom, among the highest paid in the nation.
Yeah, the effort has bipartisan support as well, but there are lots of unsettled questions before teachers will see any bump in their paychecks. What about experienced teachers? Should teachers living in more expensive cities get more? And where would all the money come from? We spoke about the effort to raise starting teacher pay with Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Teacher unions here in Florida have called the governor's proposed teacher pay raise a start. Is it a start in your estimation, or is it a destination?
Well, I would say that it is a bold action on behalf of this governor, and it is absolutely a destination. So what the governor has unveiled in his teacher pay proposal is obviously a significant increase in the minimum starting salary for full-time classroom teachers. And really what his goal was to get us from where we're at currently, which is sort of middle of the pack, vis-a-vis some of the other states, to number two in the country. Unfortunately, I don't think we got the reaction from the teachers union. I think that's more political theater than anything else. But I think that what we've set out to accomplish is recognizing that there's an issue with our teacher pay, recognizing that we as Florida's executive branch need to lead on that issue, and also really putting forward a proposal that I think the legislature can work with. Obviously, they ultimately have the responsibility to appropriate the dollars, and so I think we'll have a spirited discussion over the course of the next 2 months, but I do think it's a destination.
So it being a destination, does that mean that it's unlikely to go any higher? I think some of the teacher unions, and especially some of the higher cost of living locations in Florida, would like to see that number moved up from $47,500.
Well, sure. I think that there's a lot of nuance that's going to go into the discussion making around the policy. We're flexible. I think the governor has always shown that he's respectful of the legislative branch and their authority, and that he's respectful of the process. So what we hope to accomplish is at the end of the day, when we're done with session in about 60 days, what we'll see is a significant increase in teacher pay, something that's going to really be meaningful. And the way the governor unveiled it, right now, as it stands, it would provide more than 101,000 teachers with a pay raise. That's a significant number, and I think that that's something that, you know, everyone should get behind.
How wedded is the governor and his administration to the $47,500 number?
Well, it's a significant number. And
significant from where it is clear. Now, but is it, you know, is that going to be the ceiling of first-year teacher pay in Florida that the governor is essentially going to stand for?
Clearly, I would say that that's dependent upon our work with the legislature. And so we're talking over $600 million to be able to accomplish that goal, that number that you spoke about, the $47,500. But ultimately, I think what we're hoping to accomplish is to get us to where we would like to be, which is leading the nation or close therein.
Among the 2 points that I imagine are going to be negotiated are on the table. One is how the governor's proposal deals with veteran teachers that have not been party to pay raises over the past several years, and this $47,500 may be close to what veteran teachers are already making. And of course, the details around cost of living differences between high cost of living places and lower cost of living places. How is the governor approaching, how are you approaching those 2 points as it relates to teacher pay?
I would say that we have obviously tried to address veteran teachers, not just vis-a-vis this particular proposal, but even last year, as the governor looked to revamp and reinvest in the bonus program, which was a bonus program that all teachers could have.
That so bonus program would go by the wayside, though, under the governor's proposal here for teacher pay.
Clearly. So
how do you deal with veteran teachers going forward?
So that's going to be something that we're going to continue to talk with our legislative partners. We're going to continue to push the envelope and make sure that we recognize that we have to not only invest in our starting teachers, you have to start somewhere, right? The cost of living issue is something that's going to be really important to continue to focus on, and we're going to continue to want to look at ways to address those issues. But, you know, we had to start somewhere. I think the governor understands that there are nuances to this policy, this change in policy.
So, Lieutenant Governor, do you think there's room then for a cost of living difference in this proposal? And if so, does that still accomplish the governor's ultimate ambition?
No, I think there's always room to discuss different approaches. The governor is very respectful of the legislative branch. He recognizes that they have a role to play and that they're separate, the equal powers, and that we're going to continue to work with them. And so if there are other ways to potentially get to our goal, I would tell you, he has generally shown a willingness to work with our legislative partners, to listen to different approaches, as long as we can all come together and have a win and have a victory on behalf of Florida teachers.
So let me ask you this then, in regards to that, is the guardrail on those negotiations the total amount of money that the governor would like to spend on this, the $600 million or so that he would like to allocate toward additional teacher pay?
Obviously, that's the amount that he's set aside in his budget proposal. But again, it's a complex negotiation because ultimately the legislature has the appropriations responsibility.
Sure.
So we're going to have to walk that fine line. We're going to have a delicate balance between not just the total number allocated, how it gets allocated, how it accomplishes our goal, how it gets us from middle of the pack to basically top in the country.
Lieutenant Governor, on the spending side, are you approaching these $600 million as new dollars to be spent, or are you looking at other programs to pull dollars from in order to reach the governor's goal?
We're willing to let the legislature work through those discussions and those potential points of contention, if you will. But what we're eager to accomplish is the ultimate goal. And so if they have a different way to get there, and we're willing to take
sure.
a look at it.
Yeah, but if it comes at the cost of another priority for the governor, financially speaking, you know, that's about those types of decisions that he would have to make within the budget when it lands on his desk, presumably sometime in the spring.
Correct. He would. So that's why we're working really hard, making sure that his priorities, not just on this particular issue that we've been focused our conversation around on teacher pay, but, you know, he has a really bold agenda as it relates to the environment, and that's over $600 million as well. And so, you know, I think that we view things not as a zero-sum game. I think that we view things holistically and comprehensively. You know, there's ample opportunity to be able to fulfill our responsibility to Floridians in terms of investing in our environment, investing in our teachers, investing in our infrastructure. You know, hurricane recovery continues to be something that we're focused on. You know, our friends in the Panhandle are
for Hurricane Michael.
So obviously there's no limit to the number of things that we have in terms of our priorities, and but we have finite resources. And
right,
we also
limited
want to
dollars.
So,
right, you know, in that regard, are lottery dollars on the table in your estimation when it comes to the teacher pay proposals?
Well, obviously, lottery dollars are allocated for various programs, and Bright Futures, you know, is one of the more popular ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got to be mindful of how we go around sort of, you know, taking from here, robbing Peter to pay Paul, et cetera. And so, you know, the governor has shown that he has a principled fiscal conservatism as it relates to not just being good stewards of our taxpayers' dollars, but also with regards to funds that are, you know, they're allocated for specific purposes.
So it sounds like you'd prefer to avoid dipping into the lottery funds.
Yeah, well, I don't want to speak for him, you know, in terms of, you know, ultimately, how do we get to where our number is? But I think he would, you know, he would rather see this conversation focused around how do we find this funding? How do we fund this particular aspect and make sure we do it in a way that's going to be meaningful?
That's Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez. Now, we'll be taking your phone calls and tweets later on in the program, 305-995-1800 and @FloridaRoundup.
Meanwhile, on Monday, thousands of teachers are expected to rally in Tallahassee at the state capitol. The Florida Education Association is pushing for more money for public schools, including bigger pay raises for teachers. Frederick Ingram is the president of the Florida Education Association.
So there's always a need for teachers and educational support professionals and stakeholders to speak up for public schools. And let me say about the governor's plan, that we appreciate the effort, but there is a better way to deal with the over 3,000 classrooms that did not have a certified teacher this year. There's a better way to deal with the exodus of teachers that we see in our classrooms every day. There's a better way to not divide our teachers and just dealing with beginning an entry-level salary and pitting veteran teachers against a particular pay plan. We believe that there's a more equitable way to do that. And we also believe as a part of this $900 million package, there's still a $300 million part of that that says we're going to exercise that in bonuses. Bonuses are wrong. The research tells us that they have not worked in many different iterations here in the state of Florida. So our teachers and our supporters and our stakeholders are coming to Tallahassee simply because we want to make things right. And we believe that there's a better way to do what we're trying to do, and that is provide every classroom with a quality teacher and support all of our educational stakeholders, inclusive of the educational employees that work in all of our schools.
And what I hear you saying in part is that the teachers union in this state, while you might like the raise for some teachers, you're saying that might be unfair to veteran teachers who already make above that threshold?
Well, not only who don't make above that threshold, who are right at the threshold. There are teachers who will not see any part of this plan from the governor at all, you know, who teach in certain situations. They could be counselors. They could be speech-language pathologists, and they could be pre-K teachers. Those folks are not included in the governor's pay plan as it relates to bonuses and in some parts of this entry-level salary. We have veteran teachers that put the school districts, the public school districts, on their shoulders each and every day. And we ought to be talking about every single teacher in our school district. There are over 200,000 teachers in our public schools, and we can come up with a pay plan that is equitable for all of them. We have the money to do it. This is not about skill. This is about will.
How do you plan to lobby the legislature around this? Governor DeSantis is coming into this 60-day legislative session with high approval ratings. He's going to try to pursue this agenda, but some of his fellow Republican legislators might not want to commit to a $900 million spending plan for education.
So I believe that they should. I believe that you have to devise a plan that is 360 degrees. We continue to have conversations with the governor's office. We continue to have conversations with the Speaker of the House, with the Senate president. We continue to try to work on both sides of the aisle. If you put children first, we always win. And I like to say if you put children first, we always find our way home. And home is student success. Home is to recruit and retain the best educators and to formulate the proper investment. And part of that strategy is to start our legislative session with parents and students and teachers crying aloud, but crying with one voice, saying that we must do better by our public schools because we are 47th in the nation in teacher pay. We are 43rd in per pupil spending as it relates to the rest of the nation. And that's shameful. While the governor holds an approval rating that is favorable, I will tell you that there will be thousands here who take exception with the pay plan that is coming from the governor's office.
Let me ask you about school safety as well, because certainly the legislature will be looking at that issue. There's a grand jury investigating school safety. They're asking state lawmakers to get tough on districts that aren't following laws that have been passed since the mass shooting in Parkland. Where does your organization stand on school safety, and what are your biggest concerns?
So school safety is our number one issue. We want children to come to school, be in a safe, secure environment. We want them to go home the same way we found them physically. And so with that said, we need to get at the root of the problem as it relates to school safety. That is having more counselors and nurses, mental health therapists, and giving teachers the opportunity to talk to students and not being driven by some kind of test, not being driven by teacher evaluations, not being driven by bonus or performance pay. There is an opportunity for us to really create magic between a teacher and a student if we give them the time and the space to have an educational environment that actually works and is productive towards having conversations. Our young people need to talk. Our young people need to talk to adults that we trust. They need these counselors, and our counselor ratio is completely skewed, and we should be getting to the root of the problem, not talking about guns, not talking about punitive measures. If a school doesn't do this or complies with the law, then it's going to cost them some amount of money. Those are the wrong conversations. That doesn't get at the root of the problem. The root of the problem we can stop if we teach our young people to solve problems, to make good decisions, and to be take the moral high ground.
Now, the governor's proposed budget has called for increased mental health funding for schools. Are you arguing, as head of the FEA, that that should go toward more counselors on school campuses so that students have more access to that kind of mental health assistance?
That is something we absolutely agree with. Of course, we need more mental health therapists. We need more counselors. And we also need the current counselors to be able to do their jobs, not to be test proctors, not to be quasi-administrators, not to be called off to do other work. They have a skill set that they have gone to school for, they've been trained for, and we trust them to do that. But now we need to work on the time allotment to give them the time and space to actually counsel students. You know, counselors are important. They are just as important as anybody else in a school system. And unfortunately, in too many instances, we don't give our counselors the time and space to deal with children in the way that they should.
Now, you've brought up standardized testing a few times in our discussion. Is the Florida Education Association trying to get the legislature to consider doing away with high-stakes testing in the state schools? Is that your position, to just not have standardized tests anymore?
No, that is not our position. And our position has never been not to test students or not to have an accountability system. Our position is if we have tests, and when we have tests, and we will always have tests. You know, I always say teachers are not afraid of tests. In fact, we invented tests. We know how to teach students. We know how to prepare them for tests, but they're tests that are driven by by the teacher, by the school, by the district, not by Tallahassee, not by the Department of Education. And these are not tests that are attached to such high stakes that students get nervous, or students get sick before they take the test, or that these punitive measures, if a student doesn't pass a test, then the teacher has to go to another school, or we have to reconstitute the public system around that particular student because of that. It's the high stakes that are attached to these tests that are the problem. And the other part of the test here in the state of Florida is that we continue to change the goalposts. With our tests come these new standards, and we understand that the Commissioner of Education and the Department of Education is now promulgating new standards. You know, our teachers know best, and unfortunately, those on high at the Department of Education and under the direction of our governor and lawmakers have not done a real job at communicating with practitioners, with the people on the ground, with the people with students. We know best, and if you allow us the chance and the opportunity to help with these standards, they can be something that everybody can be successful doing.
Well, Frederick Ingram, we appreciate your time. Thanks for appearing on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you so much.
Frederick Ingram is president of the Florida Education Association. We'll be taking your phone calls and tweets about teacher pay and education later in the hour.
Still to come, the push to require all Florida companies to check the immigration status of new employees. That's next.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. When Ron DeSantis was running for governor in 2018, he pledged to require Florida companies to check the immigration status of new workers. It's a federal government system called E-Verify. It uses information provided by workers against Social Security and immigration records.
That's right. Now, several other southern states have enacted similar laws, and this whole E-Verify matter has become part of the overall national debate over immigration. We want to know what you think about E-Verify and immigration reform. We'll get to your phone calls and tweets later in the hour. Join us here on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup.
Now, previous efforts to get an E-Verify bill through the Florida legislature have failed. Earlier, we spoke about the governor's priority with Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez. What is the goal of the governor's push to require Florida employers to use the federal E-Verify system?
This is something that should come as no surprise. I think he was very, very vocal about it on the campaign trail. You know, obviously there's concerns about the corporations and hiring undocumented and how that impacts Floridians that are looking for high paying and other skilled opportunities within our state.
So is this after undocumented immigrants working in high paying skilled work in Florida?
No, I wouldn't say it's focused on that in particular. What I would say is that, you know, he's heard from a number of individuals. He's heard from different communities that that's important. It's an issue that's important. We want to make sure that our corporations are abiding and doing the right thing. And so I think his focus is always Floridians first. And so I think that's something that he's trying to fulfill one of his campaign promises.
How many undocumented immigrants are working in Florida? Any estimation?
I don't have those numbers in front of me. But, you know, I think ultimately his view is that this is something, it's been an ongoing issue. It's something that he spoke about, that he's heard from individuals throughout the entirety of the state. And I think that's something that he wants to tackle.
I know when you hear from folks, especially in the agricultural community and industry, many are opposed to this kind of regulation and how it may limit their availability to labor. And I know those folks have talked to the governor as well. How do you answer those critics?
What I would say is, you know, there's never an excuse to not abide. To not do the right thing, to not comply with the law. And so I have no doubt Florida industries, in particular agriculture, have the ability to adapt and adjust.
Florida requires public employers and state contractors to use E-Verify, and that has been the law for those folks for a few years. Any idea what the results have been from that?
You know, I don't have specific results for you, but I could tell you that I think that the playing field should be the same for everyone, no matter what industry you're in.
So any sense of the several years that the Florida government has required the use of contractors to use E-Verify of canceled contracts or any other kind of enforcement action that have taken by folks that have violated, that have been found that employees are not properly documented?
Generally speaking, I'll tell you when corporations, particularly those that do business with the state, when they're held to a standard, they typically tend to button up and to do what they're required to do. And so, you know, whether it's been a burden, I have not heard that. Whether there's been canceled contracts because of vendors that refuse to comply, I have not heard that either.
What resources will the state need to enforce E-Verify if all companies in Florida are required to use it?
I haven't seen any analysis in terms of additional resources that we'd be needing. I would assume we could probably absorb a lot of that through our existing agencies or departments that would be assigned the task of responsibility or of enforcement. But again, I typically tend to see that when corporations are put on notice, they tend to do the right thing. They tend to comply. You know, obviously.
So is that a trust but not verify kind of enforcement?
No, absolutely not. I think it would be trust and verify. Clearly, we would have an enforcement aspect of it. Clearly, we would have additional FTs that perhaps may take on a burden at that point in time when this is implemented. But I think that we could manage most of it within our existing resources without costing too much to the taxpayer.
But there would have to be some additional state resources toward auditing or enforcement, wouldn't there?
Sure. I mean,
using the E-Verify system costs anywhere from $3 to $60 per job applicant based upon the size of the company. The bigger companies pay less per head because they're doing more through the system. Ideally, under the governor's vision for E-Verify, who pays that? The companies?
Well, you know, our business, we have a focus on being obviously very pro-business here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And each and every day we get the opportunity to see new businesses come to Florida or existing businesses grow here in Florida. And so we don't take lightly, any additional burdens and things of that nature. But clearly, you know, this is a responsibility that they have. And so this is something that they've been If they've been violating the law, they've been doing it either knowingly or unwittingly. And so obviously, you know, corporations need to comply. And so that's something that they would have to take on.
Research from the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, which looked at states including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, North and South Carolina, fellow states of Florida here in the southeastern United States that have E-Verify in place. And the Dallas Federal Reserve study found that, quote, these laws' primary impact is preventing or delaying growth in the number of unauthorized immigrants living and working in a state. As most Floridians know, Florida is a state that is rich in history when it comes to immigration, and the economy rests to some degree on healthy immigration. What could be the impact on sales taxes and other kind of local taxes that are paid by those working unauthorized immigrants that may be affected if E-Verify is put in place in Florida?
Well, you know, Tom, I'm the daughter of immigrants, so I fully understand the importance of immigration to not just Florida, but obviously my home of South Florida. Mm-hmm. You know, Miami is a city that really was built to the prominence that it now has because of people like my parents and others that came before and after them. But what I'll tell you is that, you know, my parents and many other immigrants have come through the legal process. And so, you know, any impact to our economy is something that I think that, you know, I don't believe will be a significant impact. I don't believe it'll create a economic problem for Florida.
The governor has also talked about crime as it relates to undocumented immigration and his priority for E-Verify. He said that the system is needed to address violence by undocumented immigrants. What specifically is the administration referring to there?
Well, I would venture to guess, and I don't like to put words in the governor's mouth, but I would venture to guess that there are crimes being committed in our communities by people that are here illegally. That's something that we want to be able to flesh out, and we want to be able to ensure, because, again, this is something that he was very vocal on during the campaign trail in terms of making sure that Florida's crime rate not only reduces, but that we're addressing any violent crime in a robust, comprehensive way.
Alabama, Arizona, South Carolina, three states that have E-Verify in place, and Florida's violent crime rate, according to FBI statistics, is lower than those three states. So is there a real problem here that E-Verify is addressing when it comes to violent crime in Florida?
Well, while our violent crime rate may be lower than those states that you mentioned, any violent crime that takes place in any of our communities under the governor's watch is something that he's concerned about. So whether it's one or, 100,000, I think that's something that, you know, that weighs on him, and not only as a former prosecutor, but as a father. And so I think that, how do you look parents in the eye, those parents that their children have fallen victim to a crime, and really just say, you know, we our crime rate was low, as enough as it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot minimize the pain and suffering that goes into the families that are that having to deal with a violent crime, no matter where it is.
That's Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez talking about E-Verify, the federal system to check the immigration status of workers. It's one of Governor Ron DeSantis's top priorities for the legislative session that begins on Tuesday. We'll be taking your phone calls and tweets later on in this program. You can line them up now, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or at Florida Roundup. And you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Well, what do business owners think about E-Verify? Tony DeMari warns that his industry and even the state's economy will be hurt if E-Verify becomes law in Florida. He's vice president at DeMari Farms, one of the biggest tomato growers in the nation. We spoke with him. Let's listen. Tony DeMari, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome, Melissa.
Let's talk about E-Verify. Your company, DeMari Fresh, is one of the largest tomato producers in America. You and your leadership have spoken out against the use of E-Verify in Florida. You've said it would destroy Florida's agriculture and service economy. Why are you so opposed?
Well, first of all, there are many reasons. I feel this is more of a federal issue than a state issue, certainly. We've got a serious problem, you know, in this country, obviously, with the immigration. As it relates to the state of Florida, you know, we've got a tremendous low unemployment rate right now. A lot of areas are in the 3-3.5% range, you know, at that level. you know, you're actually almost looking at full employment, in the state of Florida. And, you know, we are obviously very reliant on the service industry. We have obviously a huge ag industry in the state. And we also, you know, with the development and growth that's going on in this state, there's obviously a lot of construction. And I feel with the level of unemployment, where we're at right now, implementing a program that has some problems to it. So you don't have a perfect system in the E-Verify programs around the country, those that are being implemented now. And I think that, you know, a program like this, if implemented in the state of Florida, would cause devastating effect to a lot of industries. And it would be detrimental economically, short-term and long-term, you know, in my view.
Well, so, let me ask you as a follow-up. Yep. Do you know the status of your employees and your contract workers? Do you know how many of them are undocumented?
We verify every employee that works for us. The documentation that our employees provide, we have to take at face value. They're required to present two forms of identification, either, you know, birth certificate, driver's license, a green card, or a passport. So we go through all the rigors and that are required by the federal government when we employ our people. That's not our job as an employer to scrutinize and potentially discriminate against any potential employee. And we've gone down that route before, and so have others, and been sued by the government for discrimination. That's the federal government's job, is to enforce the immigration laws of this country. That is not for an individual employer to do.
But let me ask you, though, if you're checking their status through other means, why not just take the extra step of running a new hire, a potential new hire's name, through the E-Verify system?
Well, because we think that this system is flawed, and there is a margin of error. And again, I think, you know, with a system like that, you'd be, in essence, potentially discriminating against some folks that are legitimate as far as their legal status. The federal government needs to look at and do a better job of immigration reform.
Opponents of your position might argue that the real reason you oppose E-Verify is because you theoretically can pay an undocumented tomato picker less than an American citizen, that this is simply a way for you to save money.
I can tell you right now, we do not have any undocumented workers. 100% of our workers are fully documented, and that's not unlike other agricultural employers in the state of Florida. We document every single individual that works for us. Now, it's not my job as an employer to scrutinize the documents that are being presented. We have to take them, as the federal government says, at face value. As long as they're presenting documentation that's required for employment, that I am fulfilling my responsibility as an employer. Let me be clear. I'm not for illegal immigration. I'm for securing our borders and having due process. But it should not be the employer's responsibility to go beyond it. That's the federal government's job.
If you don't think E-Verify is the solution, what is the solution in your view?
Well, I don't know what it is, but I do know this, with the unemployment rates being what they are, and the fact that if they were to implement a program that scrutinizes a percentage of the working people, I know that it would cause a dramatic negative economic effect on this state.
Earlier in the show, we spoke with Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez. She told us that Governor DeSantis has heard from companies who say they're concerned about an uneven playing field for hiring workers.
I don't know what she was referring to as far as uneven. What is she referring to as uneven playing field?
Well, perhaps in what you're paying them. You know, what their wages are.
I can assure you we're paying the minimum wage. In fact, our workers make well in excess of minimum wage because we pay piece rates. And the average piece rate in our industry equates to about $15 an hour when you convert the piece rate back to the hours worked. we pay an average of $15 an hour. So I'll argue with anybody anytime. You show me where we're not paying fair wages.
Okay. But you'll continue to lobby against it as the legislative session gets underway. How will Damari Fresh make its voice heard in Tallahassee on this issue?
Well, we'll continue to oppose it until the federal government can implement a guest worker program to effectively address the work shortage, and not only in our industry, there's a significant shortage of labor in this country. And what we're asking for is for the federal government to implement a viable guest worker program, since we don't have enough labor within the U.S. borders, to apply for guest workers to come in on a temporary basis, harvest our crops, and then go back to their countries when they're done with the work.
We're out of time, but I want to thank you for engaging on this contentious issue. Thank you for appearing with us here on the Florida Roundup to talk E-Verify. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Melissa. You have a good day.
E-Verify is just one of the top issues for Governor Ron DeSantis in the 2020 legislative session. That session begins on Tuesday in Tallahassee. Teacher pay is also a centerpiece of the governor's agenda. So let's hear from you. Should the state require Florida companies to check the immigration status of new workers? How much should public school teachers be paid in the state of Florida? What about a starting pay? Should there be a difference based upon where they live and the cost of living in their towns? And what other issue for lawmakers is on your mind as the new legislative session begins next week? The environment, taxes, transportation. We'll be taking your phone calls and your tweets next. You can line them up now, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or on Twitter, at Florida Roundup is our handle. It's all to come next as the Florida Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville as we continue talking about two of the governor's big priorities for the upcoming legislative session. It kicks off next week. He wants to raise minimum teacher pay in Florida to $47,500 a year. And he also wants Florida companies to be required to check the immigration status of their workers. Lots of tweets already coming into the show, and we want your calls, 305-995-1800, here to the Florida Roundup, as we welcome Lynn Hatter, the news director at WFSU in Tallahassee. She's covering the Capitol. And Lynn, how do you expect the legislature to respond to these two big priorities, beginning with teacher pay?
Well, I definitely think you are going to see movement on the teacher pay issue. The question is, how do you get it done?
Let me get to a couple of tweets while we wait to reconnect her, Tom. It's incredible how much people have been weighing in about this. Here's a tweet about pay. They need to increase it for all teachers and support staff. We are losing teachers every day because of poor pay and lack of leadership and development opportunities. That just gives you an idea of the sentiment we're getting about teacher pay. I think we do have Lynn back on the line now. Hey, Lynn, clearly the Twitterverse is in favor of giving teachers a raise, but will the legislature be?
Yeah, the legislature is going to move on this issue. You already have plans for this in the works. The question is going to be, how much is it going to be and how are they going to distribute the funding, though? Because this issue of teacher pay, that's something that's negotiated between local school districts and their local unions. So the legislature has to really thread this needle carefully. But I do believe that you are going to see salaries go up. The question is, how exactly are they going to do it?
And what do you think about the reception from the legislature about E-Verify? We've seen previous efforts fail by the time the end of the session comes.
You have, and I think it's important to note that they have failed in both the House and the Senate. There was a proposal last year that would have required private employers use E-Verify. It was never heard in the House. And Senate President Bill Galvano has been very clear that he is not supportive of it in the Senate. The question is going to come down to one of persuasion. Is this something that Governor Ron DeSantis wants to use a lot of his political capital on? You've already heard from previous speakers who talk about, you know, tourism and agriculture are two of our biggest industries. They are also among some of our lowest paid industries. And while E-Verify is highly accurate, there is still very much concerns about the impact to workers in those industries. And so I am not as sure. Senate President Bill Galvano has talked about maybe not going so far as to require all private employers use it. He's talked about a smaller proposal. What that looks like, I don't know. I have not seen it yet. But is this something that's going to get through? I think it's going to be part of the conversation, but I don't know, you know, if the governor has to choose between does he want teacher pay or does he want E-Verify. My assumption is he is likely going to choose teacher pay.
Interesting. Here's a tweet, meanwhile, from Jay. He says, the whole E-Verify mandate is just a meaningless talking point that makes DeSantis look serious about immigration. Enforcement would cripple many industries in Florida, and that's anti-business. Well, that's one opinion. Let's get another one. It's Joe in Jacksonville. He's on the line. Hi, Joe. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was just calling because my experience, as that came from being a mortgage lender, it really seemed that that the e-verification system was a shield, or that the lack of enforcing on the state level was a shield that the federal government provided companies to not have to take any responsibility for the employment status or the documentation status for their employees, and therefore the only one that takes the brunt of any type of enforcement of that policy are the workers themselves, and therefore they continue to get raided or cleaned out, and everyone gets deported, and then. They go ahead and do it right over again because there's absolutely no penalty for employers to not have to enforce that policy.
And that's how you experienced it at your office?
Well, I had a client who thought that their verification was strong enough because they got through their employer to try to go ahead and buy a home. And the last minute, they realized that this was not going to work out. And they got terrified. And I could no longer talk to them. I could no longer explain this situation to them, and they had escrow money to buy a home. And luckily enough, there was ways through the contract where they were able to get their money back, which was $10,000, which was a lot of money. But that was just one situation. But in general, there's no enforcement, and
I gotcha.
The only ones that suffer are the workers themselves.
All right, and that's Joe in Jacksonville. Thank you for that, Joe.
Tony in Tampa. Tony, you've been holding on. Thanks for your patience. You're on the radio now.
Thank you. Yeah, for me, I started in the construction industry in 1981, and it was primarily just blacks and whites. We rarely even seen Latino. My father's from Cuba, my wife's from Ecuador, so I'm not anti-immigrant in any way, shape, or form. But after the Reagan amnesty in 86, as of 1992, you couldn't find an African-American on a job site. You could not until like 2010 did I start to see one or two happen along the interstate when I saw road construction and whatnot. And I think it really was, it decimated the African-American community contribution and work and their opportunities. And quite frankly, I'm pro E-Verify, and I'm also pro rating offices and businesses that are anticipated to use undocumented workers and find them accordingly, because that's the only way you're going to really be able to protect the U.S. citizens, and for me, the African-American community.
Tony, we get it. Thanks for adding your voice to the conversation here on the Florida Roundup. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Lynn Hatter at WFSU in Tallahassee. Is the governor willing to spend his political capital on essentially a federal issue, immigration?
I don't know if he is. You know, you talked to Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez about this issue earlier, and she said, you know, I haven't heard much about, you know, some of these issues that people have brought up. It's a big question. This is not, and it has not been, a very popular issue in the state of Florida. This has been tried many times. The last time we attempted it, we settled on requiring, you know, public sector to use E-Verify, but we did not do private sector. And these are very powerful sectors: the state's agriculture industry, the state's tourism industry, the state's construction industry. All three of these groups have historically lobbied against this proposal. So again, you know, how much political capital does Governor DeSantis want to spend? I think we'd have to ask the governor that question. But I will say that once this was floated, it's not been talked about all that much ever since it was first raised. And I think that may portend that this is not something that is going to become a blanket policy. You might see the legislature maybe try to appease and do some other legislation around it when it comes to enforcement. The legislature loves to talk about we need to enforce current laws, so they might take up something that deals with enforcement. But will you get a complete, you know, everyone has to use E-Verify? I don't know if that is something that will happen based upon what we've seen previously. But I think it's also important to note that, you know, we said that about sanctuary cities, given that the Senate had historically opposed that. And you saw the Senate last year switch gears and endorse it. So anything can happen.
Okay, let's get in one more call. It's Theodore in Tampa. Go ahead, Theodore. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, my thoughts are we're focusing on the wrong issue, because basically, when it comes to immigration, the legal system is a mess. And if you don't fix that first, you're going to have a lot of people that are undocumented because the laws are unrealistic. So you have to fix it at the root of the problem, because the United States is one of the only first world countries where you cannot even self-sponsor yourself to come in. It's very difficult to do that. So I think that's where the conversation should be focused on.
Okay.
If you focus on just enforcement, you're not going to get anywhere.
Thanks for that. And as you noted, Lynn, this ultimately is a federal issue. And so as the legislative session kicks off, we'll be watching those two movements closely. Before we let you go, anything else that you think will be important to track?
I think one of the big emergent issues is this issue of the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. It sounds very complicated, but this is basically the group that provides funding for people who have disabilities like Down syndrome. There's been a lot of talk about changing some of these formulas, and this agency deals with some of Florida's most vulnerable people. And so watching the conversation about how the legislature moves forward with budgeting for that agency is going to be something that I am very, very interested in, because it affects so many people. And again, some of Florida's most vulnerable people.
Lynn, it is a 60-day session. Of course, this is an election year. The lawmakers cannot fundraise for their elections during the legislative session. Is that the incentive to end on time?
as long as they end before 3 a.m., I will be happy. But, you know, at the end of session, it's all about the budget. It's all about making these dollars work and the numbers work. And so that is usually the thing that pushes session into the wee hours and early mornings. That will always probably be the thing that pushes us over. But I don't think that they're going to have to extend too long if they have an extension. It'll just be a very late night.
Late night and a long session, some early mornings and late nights. Lynn Hatter, the news director at our sister station in Tallahassee, watching over all of that and helping us out throughout South Florida and throughout all of Florida in public radio and public media covering the legislature. Always great to have you on, Lynn. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And it was great to hear from the lieutenant governor this hour and some other great guests. Lots of big issues on tap for Florida as we kick off 2020. We'll be tracking them every Friday on this show. And that is our show for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, also our technical director this hour. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz, and we get engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back here next Friday at noon.